Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I learned quite early on, if I was going out to photograph the former Taoiseach Charles Haughey at Abbeville, his Gandon design mansion in Kinsealy, County Dublin, I was as well to take a taxi. It was a task I had a couple of times a year when I worked as a photographer with the Sunday Independent newspaper. And regardless of the reason for the photograph, and regardless of the time of day it was, the chances of getting back out the large double doors without having a few drinks were very slim. Sometimes he might have one himself, but either way, he insisted on the visitor enjoying his hospitality. He indulged photographers. They didn't ask awkward questions about his wealth, and their film had no soundtrack. Mind you, I remember one early morning when there was a little nip in the air. To my great disappointment, it was chamomile tea we shared. Enjoying his hospitality confounded me. I had no time for Mr. Haughey's politics yet, on a personal basis, when I was in his presence. His renowned charm smothered any objections. It wasn't just booze he offered. There were gifts too, seasonal and thoughtful. I've left Abbeville with arms full of ripe tomatoes, which we picked from the greenhouse inside the Victorian wall garden, and pots of newly split red geraniums to share with my mother. On the days nothing else was available, a book was always an option. The day we picked the tomatoes, he pointed to the high brick wall which had just been stripped back of ivy. It had to be done because he was intending to take honey from his bees, and right or wrong, he felt the ivy, so close to the hives, was a bad idea. Some years later, I was back at Abbeville, taking another photograph of the former Taoiseach. He was in a particularly chatty mood and invited me upstairs to view his art gallery. We strolled through the adjoining rooms, the walls covered with his eclectic collection, and he explained to me the provenance of each piece. Just before we descended the steps into the large hallway, he diverted me into a room. It was a room I was very familiar with. It's where he had entertained all the press photographers after a family wedding in Kinsealy Church, some years previous, plying us with champagne and regaling us with stories. "I have something for you," he said. "I think you'll like it." There in the corner was stored a cardboard box. Mr. Haughey opened the lid, reached inside and took out a small ceramic pot. He held it close to his face and soaked in its scent before handing it over, saying, "You'll enjoy that." Written on the small earthenware jar was Abbeville honey. It was his own honey, from his own bees, in his own hives, the very hives he'd shown to me some years earlier. I was delighted, even touched that he was giving me something so special. We walked to the taxi together. As usual, he struck up conversation with the taxi driver, and as usual, he kept the chat going, talking about traffic and fares and where the driver lived, until they discovered a mutual acquaintance. Finally satisfied that the driver would leave as delighted with himself as I was with my honey, Mr. Haughey told his new fan to pass on his best regards to their mutual acquaintance, and with that, he waved us off. The drive down the straight, tree-lined lane, past the sentry box and through the iron gates, seemed interminable. But as soon as we were on the Malahide Road, I leaned back in my seat and lifted the little pot to my nose, inhaling deeply as Haughey had done. Then I prized the lid from its wax seal and peered inside. After a brief moment, I let out a howl of laughter. There was nothing in the little pot. It was completely empty. And though sealed, it had never been filled. In a way, it was wonderfully fitting. I still have the prized piece of pottery sitting proudly in our kitchen cupboard, and every few years I lift the lid and peer inside. It never fails to make me smile. I never got to taste Charlie Haughey's honey, but unlike eaten bread, it was never forgotten.
What object would you never part with? It's a standard question in a Sunday supplement interview series that I find intriguing. My answer? A battered old wooden chest in our spare bedroom with S. Campbell RN stenciled in faint letters on the lid. It was in this box that my great-granduncle carried his belongings on voyages to far-flung places in the 1860s and 1870s. It's still sturdy 150 years later, even if bits are missing from some of the corners. Chewed away by rats, my granny used to say. Samuel Campbell was a surgeon in the Royal Navy. He grew up on a farm on the Fannet Peninsula in North Donegal, and maybe the sea was in his psyche, for the fields he would have played in as a child ran down to the shores of Mulroy Bay. When I was a child, playing around that same farm with my sister on summer visits, so many stories were told about Uncle Doctor, as he was known, that we sensed his presence like a benign ghost. I have the photograph album that went with him on his travels, a small book with gilt-edged pages that must have been extra precious at a time when photography was thrillingly new. I'm looking at a picture of him now, in full dress uniform, brass buttoned and braided, a well-built man with a Victorian beard and crinkly, smiling eyes. In a more informal portrait, with his cane at a jaunty angle, he looks dapper, a dandy almost, in amongst images of Disraeli, the Prince of Wales, three-masted sloops, Japanese pagodas, and his own Donegal front door. Uncle Doctor spent most of his working life on surveying expeditions. As a keen botanist, he was encouraged to take an active part in survey work besides looking after sick seamen. His service record shows these additional duties earned him an extra 2 shillings and 6 pence a day from 1859 on, a nice little bonus at the time, with nothing to spend it on for months on end. One expedition took him through the Straits of Magellan to the southernmost tip of Patagonia. 4 watercolours on our living room wall, painted by the ship's artist, show him on horseback chasing llamas across the plains of Tierra del Fuego and parleying with a tribal chief. The chief has a fine-looking dog, which Uncle Sam apparently admired. Only, the story went, to be served the unfortunate hound later for dinner. He helped to chart the coasts of China, Japan and Korea, either fighting off or mollifying the locals, depending on how things went. In one of just 2 letters that survive, written in 1876, he describes a cruise up the North Korean coast. We steamed into a region entirely unknown, where no European had ever been. The next day, he writes, a village headman explained through an interpreter that his people thought the sailors had come to eat them and carry away their women. When Uncle Doctor was on leave, he returned to the family farm near Kerrykeel, laden with gifts, Chinese porcelain, Japanese lacquerware, a samurai sword, a carved emu's egg, even, rather rakishly, an opium pipe. He bought gold watches for his sisters and paid the school fees of his favourite niece, Mary. Later he would take Mary to London and kit her out with fancy gowns before whisking her off to the French Riviera, where he spent the winters of his retirement. Maybe he wanted to mix with the beau monde, or maybe he had a weak chest and went there for the weather. I suspect the latter. He died of pneumonia back in Donegal, having spent too much time, they said, out on duck shoots, lying in wet heather. That was all we knew about Uncle Doctor until a letter from British Columbia landed into my grandmother's lap in 1977. It was from a librarian in Campbell River on Vancouver Island. As she must know, it said, the town had been named after Dr. Samuel Campbell. Could our family provide any information that might help a local historian to flesh out a biography? Could we what? Uncle Doctor must have done something heroic to have a town named after him. My grandmother threw herself into the task, with me as willing secretary. We drew the family tree, typed up his letters, copied photographs, recorded reminiscences. Only when the booklet was published did we learn that places marked on naval surveys were routinely given the names of any crew members at all. No heroism required. But to me, Uncle Doctor was a hero, a real traveller, instead of the tame, cosseted kind I have become. What challenges he must have faced. What, I would love to know, did he make of those very foreign countries? His sea chest holds my granny's old linen tablecloths now, and my wild imaginings.
My granddaughter is 2.5 and lives in Australia with my daughter and son-in-law. They were home recently, abandoning the 40-degree heat of an Aussie summer for an Irish midwinter. It was her first visit to us when she had the words to express her wonder and fascination with things that I hope she will forever associate with Ireland, her other home. On her first day here, she donned the little gloves and woolly hat that I had ready for her. She was very excited with the gloves in particular. And once they were in place, which was no mean achievement, given that I had stupidly bought gloves with fingers as opposed to mittens, she asked if she was going to make a snowman. She has never seen snow except in books. And when it snows in books, the children always make a snowman. She dealt with her disappointment very well. We may not have had snow, but our winter weather did fascinate her. "What's that noise, Bap?" she asked one evening after dinner. She calls me Bap. There was no particular noise that I could hear, until I realised it was the wind rustling the trees in the garden and blowing the rain against the windows, making the house creak more than usual, that was catching her attention. "It's a bit stormy outside," I explained. And that began 3 weeks of her wanting to hear all about storms. The more dramatic, the better. The other thing that really fascinated her was the fire, which we lit most evenings just as darkness began to fall. The dancing flames, the smoke curling up the chimney, and the occasional crackle of wood mesmerised her. And every morning, on arriving downstairs, she would ask me, "Where's the fire gone, Bap?" The open fire is one of those increasingly rare things that not only connects her childhood to her mother's and to mine, but is a thread that stretches back through the generations of our ancestors who gathered in winter around a fire to talk, to dream and to cook. Nowadays, an open fire is no longer a necessity in our homes. Still, a fireside adds not only an element of cosiness, but an ancient focus to a room which is more usually dominated by a large screen. Conversations flow better when they are had gathered around a fireside. When I was a child, the fire was essential if you weren't to freeze in the winter. Back in the 60s and the 70s, houses weren't particularly well insulated and rarely had central heating. We kept a fire going in the kitchen all day, and come evening, my mother would engage in the decidedly risky operation of moving red-hot coals from the kitchen on a shovel into the living room to get the fire going in there. As the fire died in one room, we gathered in the other, as the rest of the house descended into the freezer. And it really was the freezer. During a cold spell, there would be ice on the bedroom windows in the morning, on the inside of the windows. As you struggled out of bed from under a layer of blankets and coats which were added for extra warmth, you moved very quickly to get dressed before frostbite set in. Our bedrooms had little fireplaces, although I don't remember them ever being lit. In winter, they were boarded up to prevent drafts. As a child, I used to wonder if I got very sick, would they light the little fire in my bedroom? Back then, coal was delivered by silent men in black who traipsed back and forwards from lorry to garden, bent over under the weight of a sack of coal, their faces blackened with soot. To me as a child, the roar of the coal as it was tipped into the bunker by these scary men only added to the sinister air of the operation. Coal men are a rarity now. Our coal fires will most likely also become a thing of the past before too long. Log burners are replacing the traditional hearth. But nothing could replace the magic of an open fire, with the crackle of wood and the flickering light that softens faces, voices and minds. The fireside is a place to dream and to listen to its gentle whisper that tells us we are warm, we are safe, and we are all connected, even the smallest of us, to those who have gone before.
I was still only 17 when I received the telegram that wet, murky Tuesday afternoon. Report SS Garlinge, Hull Docks, Saturday 3rd of April, by 12 noon for 4 p.m. sailing. Contact Dublin office. Signed, Marconi. I'd recently completed my training as a junior radio officer in the Merchant Navy, and this was to be my first solo assignment. On Friday, I caught the train from Limerick to Dublin, bus to the North Wall, and the mailboat to Holyhead. I'd opted for a first-class ticket with the intention of sleeping on a sofa and saving the price of a cabin. The first-class section was empty, save myself, an older couple dressed in duffel coats and university scarves, and a much older, very upper-class husband and wife returning to England. On leaving Dublin, we ran into one of the worst storms I had experienced in my short sea career. The violent heaving and rolling of the small ship soon began to have its effect on all of us. The university pair were sitting on a sofa at the opposite side of the bar. Suddenly, she convulsed across him and vomited into his lap. In shock, he recoiled before leaning forward and getting sick down her back. The Englishwoman, till then seated at the bar, dashed for a door. She didn't succeed. Leaning against the doorframe, she threw up before staggering out on deck. Her husband followed her as I sprinted for the other door, just making it to the toilet before succumbing. I spent the rest of the trip alone in the bar, regretting my earlier decision. We arrived in Holyhead hours late. The mail train was waiting to take us to London, but I was clearly going to miss my planned connections to Hull. I eventually arrived at the ship well over 2 hours after my reporting time. My heart sank when I saw her. She was a small, black-painted coastal cargo ship. Compared with the three ships I'd previously been on, especially the Empress of England, an immaculate, white passenger ship that just finished 4 months cruising between New York and the Caribbean, this looked as bad as it could get. A voice rang out from above. "Are you the Sparks? You better get up here fast. The captain is looking for you." The voice introduced himself as the steward and led me to the mess where the captain and several others were seated at a long narrow table finishing their lunch. The steward seated me at an empty placing directly opposite the captain. The table was perfectly set and covered with an immaculate white linen tablecloth. Even though they had all had their lunch, there was not a mark to be seen on the linen. "It's Sparks, Captain," the steward announced as if he single-handedly had found me. Barely breaking from his conversation with the first mate sitting beside him to his left, the captain eyed me with utter disdain. "All you bloody Irish are the bloody same," he snarled in a thick Welsh accent. "If you had delayed my ship's departure, I'd make sure you never sailed again." He returned to his conversation as if I never existed. To my right sat the chief engineer. Under his voice, he said, "Don't worry, it's all fine." Before I could reply, the steward returned and set my lunch before me. The sight and smell of the food reminded me of just how hungry I was. On the plate sat a pork chop, mashed potatoes, peas, gravy, and a dollop of applesauce. Grabbing my knife and fork, I set about cutting into the chop. They barely made an impression on it, let alone cut or pierce it. I pushed harder as I tried to sever some meat. The chop suddenly leapt from my plate, shooting directly towards the captain. Horrified, I saw it all in slow motion, arcing gracefully on its trajectory across the lily-white linen, followed by a meteorite trail of mash, emerald green peas, dark brown gravy speckled with an iridescent golden applesauce. Seeing the incoming missile, the captain leapt from his chair in shock, bouncing off the bulkhead behind him. The chop landed precisely where his plate had been. Wide-eyed, he stared at it and then at me, before storming out of the mess in absolute disgust. The room erupted in howls of laughter and cheering. Some primitive instinctive reflex must have fired from deep within me. I now saw myself reaching out for the wayward chop, picking it up by the bone and replacing it on my plate in the certain knowledge there would be nothing till evening meal, if even then. It was going to be a long voyage.
Takeaway. First, the seafood platter. Mackerel morsels, wild Kilmore crab, oak smoked salmon from Duncannon, and a great prawn with beady eyes and a hipster moustache stretches out on a mattress of mashed potato. All for a tenner, to eat on the spot or take home for supper. Afterwards, follow the guide from the famine relief pier to the Garden of Remembrance. Stand on the last remaining plates of Avalonian rock. Heed the warning sign of uneven ground and hidden depressions. Listen. Once the sea came up to Ballateig and the Normans planted rabbits to graze the burrow. Later, a canal was dug with pick and shovel, and starving men loaded wheelbarrows, cradled the shafts on upturned elbows, ran down the hill, gathering speed to propel them up the ramp. They glided, almost flew, on threepence a week, and a mugful of yellow meal to take away for supper.
Here's Father Says for a dim or folk eagle pin. Is father may go left it over. Ach, near all men do the oblivion.
A gale blows in from the islands, carries rain, promise of sleet. I strain into the programme. 40 days on the dry, sugarless tea, 6K runs to Nemo's Pier, spring cleaning, body and soul. The wind howls its derision, numbs my fingers, ears, my toes. Easter Sunday beckons svelte and tawny, palpitating goodness. I fight penitential gusts, brave the spite of a vengeful nor'westerly. Hailstones hop on a pagan sea. Salt spray strafes my face, sackcloth and ashes of Atlantic atonement. I make it to my gate, my door, kitchen, kettle. Warm my hands on the curve of the glass, aromas of jemison, lemon and cloves. Hit of illicit whiskey. Seraphic bliss of the fallen.
It is a truth universally acknowledged, or at least by me, that the most interesting newspaper articles are in the pages that you're rolling up to light the fire, or the pages that you're cleaning yesterday's fire ashes onto, or the pages that you're putting the smelly remnants from the fridge into prior to composting. 50 years ago, lighting the fire for my grandfather was a slow process because there was always something interesting in the papers I was supposed to be rolling into balls. So a job that should have taken 10 minutes could take 40. And even when the fire was lit, another sheet of newspaper might be used. If the fire was a bit slow, I would do what my parents did. Place a double sheet over the whole of the fire opening so that a draft would be created underneath. This was always a bit risky, especially if I found an article on the same sheet. If, while I was reading, the fire came on too quickly, it might ignite said paper, and in the midst of my resulting panic, I might lose the whole article for good, not to mention singe my eyebrows. Back then, of course, we didn't talk of recycling, but we still used newspapers in diverse ways after it had served its primary purpose of informing us. Where liquid had been spilt, or if someone was going to get sick, the newspaper on the floor was your only man. A rolled-up newspaper was, and still is, useful for swatting blue bottles. At Christmas time, we pulled off hunks from the stale loaf of bread and rolled them between our hands over a sheet of newspaper until we had a pile of breadcrumbs for the stuffing. It was a deeply satisfying process that left your hands feeling soft and cared for. The pile of breadcrumbs, it always seemed to me, felt like the ambergris that Melville wrote about in Moby Dick. Before I began to read the paper, and perhaps even before I could read at all, the daily paper also provided a little blank space on the bottom right-hand corner of the front page. The heading was Late News, and if there was no late news, my siblings and I would use those few square inches for drawing. How different from today when you can buy a ream of paper for little more than the price of a single newspaper. But supposing you had as much paper as you wanted, but you didn't dare write on it. Such was the case with Anna Akhmatova when she wrote one of her most famous poems, A Requiem. The poem is a kind of a requiem for Russia itself and for its ordinary people like Anna herself, who suffered starvation, imprisonment and exile, particularly in the Stalinist era. It begins this way. You were taken away at dawn. I followed you as one does when a corpse is being removed. Children were crying in the darkened house. A candle flared, illuminating the Mother of God. The cold of an icon was on your lips, a death-cold sweat on your brow. I will never forget this. I will gather to wail with the wives of the murdered Streltsy, inconsolably, beneath the Kremlin towers. She wrote Requiem in the 30s, but actually she didn't write the poem, she composed it. In the paranoia of Stalinist Russia, she was afraid to commit the poem to paper. Instead, she asked 12 of her women friends to learn parts of it off by heart, and when she revised it as poets do, she went back to those friends and got them to delete lines and add other lines, all without committing anything to paper. One of their number used Roman numerals in an effort to make a more memorable print on her memory. And those Roman numerals have survived in the PDF version on the internet today. It's worth reading. More recently, a young poet and mother was asked why her poems were invariably short. Her response was simple. There was no time to write while she attended to her children, so she had to remember the lines until evening when the children were in bed. Her memory had an upper limit of 20 lines or so. William Wordsworth is said to have composed the whole of Tintern Abbey while out on the walk described in the poem. Dorothy tells us that he didn't put pen to paper until he got back to the house. I wonder, though, how good was his memory? And was the written version exactly the same as the one he composed on foot? And how was he off for paper? We shall never know.
On this morning's programme, we heard Mr. Haughey's Honey by Brian Farrell. Uncle Doctor was by Mary Dewey. Gathering by Barbara Scully. S.S. Garland by Niall Kelly. Takeaway, a poem by A.M. Cussons, and that was recorded at Sunday Miscellany Live at Waterford Writers' Weekend last autumn. Sheila Meehan's poem, Ash Wednesday. And finally, Paper by Michael O'Connor. The music this morning was A Taste of Honey by Herb Alpert, South Australia by the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem, Jose Feliciano's version of Light My Fire by The Doors. We Sail the Ocean Blue from HMS Pinafore by Gilbert and Sullivan, sung by the Glyndebourne Opera Chorus with the Pro Arte Orchestra, conducted by Malcolm Sargent. Is Father Machusa Gombroiga by Kathleen Maud. And Temptation by Tom Waits, arranged by David Pilch and played on piano by Aaron Davies with Howard Levy on harmonica. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.